Just got a couple of questions. In terms of your summary that you provided, number two here, the definition of indigenous vegetation. Can you go to the definition of indigenous vegetation parts of plant? The three plant? Sorry. Oh, it's in the definition section right in front. Page 2-15, all from the bottom.
Thank you. Yep.
How does what you've written in your definition terms of this translate into something that we can put in the plane? What should it say?
I think the second thing you do is the first sentence stands exactly correct, because that's in my primary evidence, there's no dispute about that. What we should specify is that if we're talking about indigenous community, then we could put boundaries on that. And I'm suggesting that we use a one-third definition for indigenous community, so that 33% cover abundance together. Which is indigenous community, and that's what the indigenous vegetation rules apply to. So natural, it's a different community itself.
What page of your evidence is that specified?
And certainly, if you look at my primary evidence.
What page number? Or yeah. Paragraph number?
I would use 3.9 in my primary evidence. That's a three-class classification, but I do stress that the boundaries are arbitrary. And some people might suggest a four-class scale, but I'd like to keep it simple. Two classes, too simple. Three classes, easily interpretable. Four classes, getting a little bit more complex.
Okay. Thank you. In the plan as well, I'm looking at policy 33.2.1.9 on page 33-3. So this refers to the assessment of Edgar speaks on indigenous vegetation clearance to do with indigenous biodiversity values by applying those criteria. How do those criteria there relate to the ones that you've set out in both one in the value determination and two in the definition?
The key difference is under B, bullet point 3. The use of the land environments gets ruled out entirely in my classification because you're using a surrogate intercept, not a primary intercept.
Sorry, which one? Sorry?
3.2.1.9, you've got A represented,
yep.
B rarity, and then there are three bullet points under rarity.
Yes.
And the third one, where indigenous vegetation will be reduced less than 20% by the land environments, I would rule that out because I think that's using a surrogate intercept rather than primary intercept.
Okay. Do the rest of those remain?
The rest of them, I think, are very reasonable. And I think that they're very clear.
In terms of going back to your part about the definition of indigenous vegetation, are you aware of any examples in any other plans, district plans, that have a good example of that?
I think
My
reading is that councils throughout the land have struggled with this and that they have got this ambiguity in what constitutes indigenous vegetation, and that clarity and simplicity using a classification such as I propose is considerably divisive.
Sorry, are you aware of any examples?
Sorry,
I'm after an example.
I haven't quite finished yet. The examples are that people have not used that. They've used arbitrary definitions such as you reasoned in the Queensland Lakes District Plan that 20% cover, but it's inconsistent between councils and it's usually just described verbally by such as dominant or predominantly or words such as like that. So the answer is that there is, we'd be breaking new ground with this definition.
Okay,
I'm going to
go. Thank you.
Thank you. I asked my question.
Thank you for the opportunity to participate and help you try and make a decision.
Now, Mandy has not prepared a summary of her evidence, and it's relatively short and concise. Unless there is something that you particularly want her to elaborate on, I'm intending to go straight to questions. Are you going to hear about the
Yep. Oh, I've just got a couple of questions.
Yep.
How much of your land, if any, do you currently do by spray irrigation?
Over 300 hectares.
And do you also propose to increase the area we want to do that where these rules might apply? I'm trying to understand how bigger an issue is it. Can you describe what the issue is?
General improvement. And that improvement might involve repasteurising new pastures.
Right. Does that mean
fertilisation?
I don't know anything about farming. Is that new?
So
you're making brand new ground or reseeding ground that's already had grass on?
Taking across that whole range. Okay.
So that. Given what Dr. Hirsky explained in terms of how the threat species was taken out of the list, do you feel confident or whatever about understanding those rules about and do you think that would be the same for other people in the farming community?
I think the way it stands at the moment is, I think you said it, do I understand all those endangered species? Absolutely not. Is it clear what needs to happen? No. So we absolutely need it. We need that clarity, we need simplicity. And one of the big issues with farmers, and it's the space I work in, you can have the science and knowledge and technology and regulation groups all up here, but the issue is in pulling them down for farmers to understand and to be able to work with them and integrate it into your, operate the business. And the way this stands, it's just a minefield just to know where to start. And when that happens, farmers tend to sit back. I think Peter probably explained that very well. You know, sit back, because where do you start? Where do you jump in? And what are the costs to your business? And we're currently in a real paradigm of change in farming. For a number of reasons. We've got climate change facing us, we've got technology, environmental, not to say the pricings and the scheduling of what's going out here, so we need to revisit what's going on. And I also think we've got a fundamental shift amongst farmers to grappling more with the environment. And we, I think again, it's really nice to sit here as a farmer. I think it's a simple or a lot of farmer over here that we do all want the same outcomes. You know, we want to look after the land and we want to work, in a collaborative environment to make that happen and figure out a way that we can go forward and do that. probably the only other that's probably so used doing you know those sorts of methods or frameworks to go forwards absolutely, and to do it under the current suggestion with the lens, which is a model that is not suitable when we're getting down to the minutiae and the small communities that we're talking about, to use a system that wasn't built to do that or wasn't modelled up just makes it even more difficult.
You said earlier that you hadn't had, there were no SNAs identified on your property and that. Did the council come and talk to you at all about them?
We actually were quite proactive in that, from the farmer group in Wanaka. And we met with Mark and with Craig, and certainly appreciated the time and that we were able to do that, just to understand what was happening. It took quite a lot of time, because it's not as complex. So yes, we proactively tried to understand what was happening and get practical, get to, rather than somebody sitting in an office that hasn't been onto the land, actually for people to come out and say, well, what really is this? And I think they explained it well, that sitting in the office, you might get it 85% right, but you can't do that from the office. You need to go out and have a look at the geography and work through that. So we went through that process.
Was that a wider role that you played rather than just within
Ivorine Farm? I was leading the district with, I think there's four or five farmers,
right.
And so we communicated with every farmer in our each valley, had somebody in each part of Matuki, over in Glenorchy, and there's a land care group. Because of the shortness of consultation, we should be the land care groups that are here, but there's a very short turnaround for us to be involved in this process. So, yeah. And you'll notice that we've got support. Supporting evidence from the farmers whose desk has come across it. So the only other comment I made is because we're running very lean businesses, there's not a lot of leeway for support on farms. So, and when there's just not a lot of free time because we're all hard at work trying to, in the current environment, trying to make ends meet.
Yeah.
So this is a huge cost for us. Yeah.
From that work you did you were there any SNAs identified in areas where there is current irrigation occurs?
Look, I couldn't be absolutely specific on that because it was 2 months ago now.
Yeah.
Thank you for your statements, Mrs. Bell. Question is, I'm here to sort of let off on a question. I just want to continue with paragraph 9 of your statement. You mentioned there that if renewal of water rights can be secured, then farmers have to commit to conversion from traditional irrigation techniques to spray.
Yeah.
So is that water dike style irrigation?
Yeah.
So that is irrigated.
So that's about efficiency of water use.
Yep.
So that we're all heading to the same direction.
Yes.
That we've got minimum flows, and if we're going to use water, it'll be really efficient.
So what overall proportion of riffle would be appropriate for irrigation in the future? What would be the maximum amount of land that you think you might be able to irrigate?
I haven't got the exact figures, but
I just read.
Yes, so look in the we'll be looking at is probably another 100 hectares, so that we would like to be going down that pathway. Now the reason that we, when you go through the process with the regional council, they have what they call command areas, and the command area is the total command area within our scheme of critical water that can be irrigated, and then we look at minimum flows in the creek, and we work to understand how much water is needed at 7 times, 5 mils goes on the land, therefore how much water is needed. So that's all part of that process.
Okay. So can I ask one related to that? Do you have any of this
water diving?
Irrigation?
Not currently. We have just moved through. The thing with water diving is you have mounds.
Mm.
phone, I think you commented that we need, you know, you'll be getting years likely, I think, to have, because you might have more boiling and water. But you've actually got the option that you could have, and farmers still do have water diving, absolutely, on those, you know, the creation of that system, there could easily be plants on those mounds. Yeah, those barriers.
Just to put that in context, what is the size of Cripple?
2,000 hectares.
2,000?
Yeah. So sort of the aim is, and look, I think I put it at the start of my submission, I'm pretty proactive in trying to run a property that takes account of all the land conversations that I'm particularly interested in working on, water quality and catchment. We've got the same sort of issues of making it easy for people to work through and understand what we should be doing. So what part of that of looking after the land is to, we've got some wonderful hill country and we have to make a living, so it comes down to stock units and efficiencies. You know, we can intensify on a smaller part of the land, and then we've got the other, you know, place takes to get the right balance. That's what we're continually trying to figure out. Yeah.
Okay, and just staying on that passage from your paragraph 9, if you were successful in renewing your water rights,
yeah,
and you had the water available to you, you're saying that in order to achieve 80% efficiency, you've got to be able to use that water, otherwise you lose the right, is that?
Not Phil's more of an expert on that. I don't know if I should come with a question to you, because that's quite a big, it's a big question. And I've just been down with ORC last week, looking at our conditions, and that's sort of the old, there's some phrases that are in there, actually, isn't probably the most...
The council, the regional council can sort of take back water rights that haven't been utilised for in 5 years.
So if you haven't used them for 5 years, then you might have to submit.
Well, it's not an entire right. It's if you've got, say, an X month right, and you've only used X minus 2, then the council can surrender the unused portion.
Yes.
Surrender's not the right word.
But I think at the end of the day, you're working to a minimum flow.
Yes.
So if you meet the minimum flow,
yeah,
and that's where we're caught in a really tricky situation, because you're not going to put infrastructure in and improve. Whilst you're sitting in this no man's land of not knowing what water there is, you don't have got infrastructure in to do that. But what's that?
And then nothing to pump.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
One thing which Andy has raised with me during the adjournment, and that is in relation to the further submissions that have been filed by JBIL. There are some that JBIL doesn't push to pursue any further.
Right.
Would it assist you to be told about that, or would you prefer that I wrote formally to the committee secretary?
Probably both.
There was a further submission in relation to Queenstown Park Limited, submitted 806. Thank you. and also also submit a 598 Stratera, STRATERA.
And they're both in the submission 1091, is that?
Yes.
Sorry. Before we start, Commissioner St. Clair, this declaration he wants to make.
Yeah, Mr. Williams present at the hearings last week at Pauwea. It turns out that my firm has the same client as your client there.
Okay.
And the site visit to that site actually occurred today by one of my staff, so I'm accusing myself from this part of it. And that has been the same with any of the submitters that have come to present evidence, and that, so with that I'll leave you to it.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
My name is Mike Coleman. I hope Mr. Tim Williams with me. He has prepared a short statement of expert evidence which has been provided. So I understand, is that correct?
Yes, I think so.
Sir, I don't have a written submission. I think the matters we wish to raise are covered in Mr. Williams' statement. And, certainly here and available to answer any questions you may have. But
right.
Hand over to Mr. Williams.
Just it was sufficiently short, I won't turn it off for not 3 minutes.
Yes, no, definitely it should be less than 10 minutes. And to help speed things along a little bit, I wouldn't read out paragraphs 1 through 5. It's a set out the basics there. And then it splits, so just sort of outline my understanding that the hearing stream we're dealing with now is just dealing with the provisions as they relate to the rural lifestyle zone in particular of interest to us, rather than any particular merits of individual sites. So this brief doesn't sort of go beyond that. Then just at paragraph 7, Mandakari Lodge Limited operates a high-end visitor accommodation facility providing accommodation for up to 32 guests with associated visitor accommodation facilities. The total combined footprint of buildings on the site is 1,924 square metres, and the visitor accommodation activity has been associated with the site since the 90s, and the site is 3.9 acres in the area and accessed off Faircroft right of way, which is about 10 minutes drive from Queenstown on the Milwaukee Road. And that's sort of just to give you a bit of a background to the submitter themselves, so a bit of context there. I'm sure you're aware that the proposed plan as it relates to the client's site zones, or proposed zone natural lifestyle with this accommodation overlay. Probably take paragraph 9 as read. Yeah. So just starting at paragraph 10.
I think with paragraph 9, isn't it fair to say that you wrote the section 32 in the book?
Predominantly, yes. There was consultation for the council and how that was brought together. But that was led by Southern Planning Group.
Just the council, legal council, identified you as the author.
Right, yes, well, I mean, that's right, there was some discussion around the rules more than anything and where they should sit as far as triggers and that side of things. That wasn't entirely driven by myself, but yes, the majority of the work was done by me. So just at paragraph 10, I'll just start reading.
Yes, that's right.
I support the provision of visitor accommodation subzones as a method within the rural living zones to provide visitor accommodation activity. In my opinion, the diversity in tourism and visitor accommodation offering in the district requires recognition that in a similar manner as people choose to live in a rural setting, some visitors prefer to stay in accommodation facilities that offer the amenity, outlook and privacy that can only be provided in a rural environment. Therefore, in my view, it is appropriate to plan for future growth and demand in this particular sector of the visitor accommodation market. The rural living zones have been identified to accommodate and provide for rural living opportunities, representing those areas of the rural environs that the Queensland Lakes District Council have identified to absorb rate change. In my opinion, it is therefore logical that where visitor accommodation also seeks a rural setting, the rural living zones are an appropriate zone for this type of activity. The use of visitor accommodation subzoning is considered to provide certainty to both visitor accommodation providers and neighbours by proactively identifying where visitor accommodation activity within the rural environment is considered appropriate. In my opinion, this is a more efficient and effective method than a case-by-case assessment through a discretionary regime and is an appropriate response in planning for growth in this particular visitor accommodation market. In my opinion, the controlled activity regime for visitor accommodation and buildings within the subzone is appropriate given the proposed controls over the bulk location of buildings. In this respect, the same setback and height controls apply irrespective of whether development is located within a subzone. This includes a restriction on the individual size of buildings of 500 square metres and setbacks from neighbouring properties. It is my view these restrictions will maintain an appropriate level of amenity, privacy and outlook to residents adjacent to nearby a visitor accommodation subzone, whilst enabling visitor accommodation activity. A cap on building area is specified in the PDP for visitor accommodation buildings. This has been set at 10% or 2,500 square metres, whichever is less. In my view, the individual characteristics of each visitor accommodation subzone will contribute to the appropriateness of this provision. However, given the process to identify individual subzones provides the opportunity for a more detailed analysis of these potential effects, greater certainty can be provided from the outset. This, in my view, is a more efficient and effective approach, directing visitor accommodation to those areas with greater ability to absorb change, whilst enabling a scale of development appropriate to encourage a more intensive visitor accommodation facility. For example, Mandakari Lodge has 1,920 square metres of building area and sits comfortably within its bush setting. I also note that the proposed provisions as they relate to the rural lifestyle zone do not appear to place a limit on the total building area within a residential building platform or the size of the platform. Therefore, a varying degree of building form is anticipated within a rural lifestyle lot, irrespective of whether it is located within a visitor accommodation subzone. In my view, this puts the proposed 10% or 2,500 square metre cap in perspective, which, when taking into account the nature of the subzoning as a method to enable visitor accommodation activity, provides an appropriate balance. And just in summary, overall, I support the use of visitor accommodation subzones as a method to recognise and provide for visitor accommodation growth that prefers a rural setting. The proposed provisions will manage potential adverse effects to neighbours through both the process to identify the location of visitor accommodation subzones and then the bulk and location controls that would apply within the subzone.
Thank you. Just at the top of that final page, you talked about each visitor accommodation subzone. Could you tell us what the other ones are, please?
Yep. So, at this stage, I understand the proposed plan identifies a visitor accommodation subzone in Makarora over the lodge site off Stool Road or something similar to that. I think it's map 16, it's the inset for Map Aurora.
It's quite small if you look for it. It's
No, I found it. It's on map 16.
Yeah, on school road.
Yes.
Yeah. By the Macarora over there. And then there's another one on Rutherford Road.
Sorry, which one?
Rutherford Road. So map 26.
Don't speak right about the road.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, sorry, no, not road, right. Road.
That's in rural residential, isn't it?
Yes, no, that's correct. Zoned to other zones, for example, Oak Ridge and Wanaka. That's currently a rural visitor zone over a rural lifestyle.
But there's a bit of confusion as to whether that is part of the plan or not, that visitor accommodation subzone.
Yeah, that one's probably a little bit more tricky because the zoning here is changing to an urban zone.
Yeah,
yeah, so you've got a bit of challenge to figure out. But,
we won't worry
but
about
in
the
one. Yeah.
Okay. I'm wondering how the rural lifestyle zone provides a requirement for 1,000 square metre building platform, or up to 1,000 square metre building platform, within which to build
and buildings outside of that are non-compliant, as a means of achieving the objectives and policies of the zone, how do you reconcile that requirement with the coverage requirement proposed for the visitor accommodation zone?
So 1,000 square metre, right, there is a, that's how I got that wrong, and there is a cap on it.
There is a building platform requirement, yes.
But there's not a cap on the size of it at the moment.
Is there?
Oh, I've got to check.
Well, I might be wrong with that. Yes.
Individual building within the platform could be no larger than 500 square metres for it to trigger a consent, irrespective of whether or not it's in the platform.
That's okay, you've identified something I wasn't aware of, that there is no limit on the size of the building platform, there's also no limit on coverage for other buildings other than the 500 square metres, which is not related to coverage.
No, that's right.
So in fact, on that basis, what is proposed for the VA is slightly more restrictive.
Yeah, I think, as I know it, that really has briefed outline there, the ability to assess the appropriateness of visitor accommodation subzoning up front, I think is the process that then can give confidence around whether or not the development that you can enable, if that's appropriate or not. So if you're being proactive by planning and then identifying where you made the VA and then whether or not those potential effects are appropriate, given the context of where you may be putting the VA subzoning.
The only other question I have then, in paragraph 13, you've got the restrictions will maintain appropriate amenity, etc., for residents adjacent to, etc.
Yes.
How also, or do you consider it necessary to achieve the policies under objective 22.2.1, which relate to visual prominence of buildings and their fitting into the landscape?
Well, I think the process identified where you put the subzoning would be part of that. So in confirming the subzoning as a method, you would want to make sure that fundamentally wasn't going to cause you any trouble down the track. That's how I saw the process would work. I don't think you would propose it as a accommodation subzone in an area that's extraordinarily sensitive, for example. Use the process of identifying where the subzone goes to ensure it.
Thanks for your evidence, Mr. Williams. Paragraph 11. Just reread that. So you're saying the rural living zones. I'm assuming building rural lifestyle is part of that.
Yes.
Are an appropriate place for the visitor accommodation subzones?
Yes, well, my logic is that the sort of the cascading approach of the district plan is that you have a landscape in the rural environment.
Yes.
And then the district plan has identified through landscape assessment areas where intensification of rural living opportunities should go, as the plan uses the rural living zoning as a tool to guide you to those particular areas.
Okay.
And so my logic is that rural living, being a spectrum between permanent residents and visitors, if they seek that same type of outlook and amenity, then it seems logical to me that those areas are the areas where it would be more appropriate.
That's a good spot for it. Yes.
Yeah.
I saw you at the hearings in Hawea 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
And you were heard that we heard from some of the neighbours.
Yes.
Of Matakari Lodge.
One neighbour.
Oh, okay.
Mrs. Scaff and
yes.
Mrs. Birch are partners.
Yes. We heard from them separately, but.
Yeah, so they
two work. Neighbours on one side.
Live in the same house.
Yes.
And they suggest
two people.
Yes, that would be the best way to describe it. Two people.
Yeah, representing one property.
Yes, and that's quite an important point to make.
Don't worry, we picked up on that.
Okay.
So their suggestion to us was that the visitor accommodation subzone was incongruous with the rural residential zone, the underlying zone. And they presented an image of Matakari Lodge sort of changing the amenity of that part of the lakefront. Are there any specific aspects or attributes of that site or that piece of land, or is there anything about it that you think makes a visitor accommodation subzone appropriate there more than anywhere else?
Yeah, well, I fundamentally disagree with the opinion on that. I think without going into that, I guess that's where we're trying to draw the line between this hearing stream and when we deal with the attributes of the site. But if you go out on that site, you can't actually see it from the walkway they're talking about. The jetty they're talking about is the jetty that Matakari put in. And when you go out of the lake to recreate, like they talked about in the kayak, and look back, you're not looking back just at the Matakari site. There's a number of other houses and buildings there.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite important to put a little bit more perspective on that.
Yeah,
just, can I just interrupt for a moment? It occurs to me for what you've raised. I'm just wondering whether it would be convenient to make a carry lodge when I took two commissioners out there tomorrow morning, so that I've visited the site already in the past week I've done. I'd be used for the other two commissioners to see the site.
Certainly, so I can arrange that if you give me a range of time.
We commence again at 11 or 11:10. So if we said 10 or thereabouts, maybe 20 past by the time we're out there.
So the context is the bush setting, which also helps to absorb more development than you might otherwise sort of imagine on a sort of rural, say you have open bit of pasture and you're proposing a lot of built form, it wouldn't sort of sit so comfortably. But you've got the topography and the vegetation that all helps to set the buildings into the landscape. And you'll see them go out on site. I mean, there's been a huge ecological restoration planting program going on there. to revegetate the environment. So there's a lot of wilding pines that have been progressively removed, and the whole area is, you know, completely re-landscaped and native vegetation to bring it sort of back more to its true sort of vegetated form it was, you know, previously.
Just might add, Commissioner, there's been a lot of litigation between neighbours and the lodge. Part of the evidence is considered in two of the hearings. By far the most prominent residents from the lake is Mr. Scapes rather than the lodge. So there's a lot of wheels within wheels going on.
Yes, we've got one there.
Unfortunately, we don't have time to do a visit from the lake.
And so the other thing we heard from your neighbour was if the area was appropriate in that way for a sort of accommodation subzone, then their preference would be that a wider area was given over to that subzone. Do you have a view on that? Do you think that the border area is more appropriate for that subzone?
Yeah, I haven't personally looked at it in any great detail, but the current subzoning follows the property boundary. So yeah, I could imagine there's some merit in looking at that, where the boundary should sit, potentially.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting that we should. I was just looking for a response to their idea. Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner. There is a land purchase negotiation going on, which might be relevant to that. Submission?
Commissioner, no. Yes, I probably should have said it at the outset. I was engaged by Lakes Environmental several years ago to consider matters raised by the neighbours in respect to the planning code development, whether they were applications been dealt with appropriately.
Oh, right. So
that's how I'm going to move.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Farr, before we do the hearing, we'd quite like to just go through that document we presented this morning. So,
talk through this through each part. Otherwise, if there's something that jumps out, I'm happy to answer that as well, or else I can talk with you from start to finish broadly, then see you much more about any questions you have.
I suppose the first question that comes up was raised because of the answer I got. From Dr. Espy. There's only the first one, the second one, the fourth one, the fifth one. How do you know that there are no threatened plants present?
That's because there's a disclaimer at the bottom.
We did hear from I think Mr. Page that it's strict liability, so I'm not sure the disclaimer would work.
Fundamentally, that's inherent through the section 32 and the chapter. It's clear that there will still be circumstances where a specialist is required to ascertain what the species are on the site. I don't think there are any rules, and from what I can understand, and myself and apparently the council ecologist will look at it. Mr. Espy's evidence in closer detail, the merits of his suggested
definition, I still don't think they would get around the need to have a specialist to identify whether or not if there's certain types of indigenous vegetation that a layperson couldn't be able to identify, and I don't think that's a reason to not potentially go that indigenous vegetation. What I've tried to make clear through the section 32 and section 42A report is that the rules as proposed, including the using the 20% threshold for structural dominance, the 30% threshold, is that putting aside those plants that you can't reasonably expect to identify, a layperson can actually apply that because it is quantitative, because there are those figures, and a layperson should be able to get a pretty good idea about whether or not the area that they propose to clear would trigger the rules. Looking at, and the reason why I've used these areas is because obviously these are the sites that are troublesome. I am reasonably familiar with the sites on the first, second, third, fourth, fifth photographs because they're on my property, and
they're not subject to these rules though, are they?
No, they're not at the moment, but who knows? That's right. But that aside, the reason why I made that point wasn't for fame at all. It was because that land wouldn't have been worked up or improved for probably 20 years. I know that the subdivision that created that, the sites where we live now, haven't got filed in 2004. So chances are there wouldn't have been any money spent on that land in terms of improving the pasture for probably quite a long time before that. So you could easily say at the beginning of the 15, even 20 years since any real investment was made from a farming point of view. And they are the troublesome sites that often get neglected in terms of the land management, and then they come into a new land ownership and they're willing to spend money on that land, invest capital into it, and then they're faced with this issue of wanting to set those paddocks up and wanting to know if the rules apply or not. Yes, there could well and truly be threatened plants. Not so much threatened plants, but plants that a layperson or that in these photos you couldn't identify. And if you look at photo 3, which has the cushion field plant, there's mosses. There seems to be mosses growing on the ground around them. I haven't included them because, you know, in terms of wanting to get the point across.
And the one after it seems pretty similar.
That's right. But, I mean, the council can respond to this in our reply, so I'm not going to sort of rebut anything, but fundamentally is that different from a development needing a certification survey for a floor level or a building height? I think if you need a level of certainty that goes beyond your ability to do so, then you need an expert, but I think that at least providing a quantitative figure to assess the area that subject to clearance, to include that, a sort of threshold in terms of the area to be cleared, and whether or not you need to include that in the permitted area, I think that's important. And I think the proposed plan achieves that. And on the second page with the flow diagram, hopefully this, the hardest, I would have liked to have referenced the rules in the flow diagram, but I didn't want to be criticised for making it too complex, so I restrained from that, but I could do that if it's requested. But the hardest part about putting this flow diagram together was, well, it wasn't that hard, but the key part is the third box down, because fundamentally the first box takes care of SNAs, the second box asks whether it's a threatened plant, because the rules say that any threatened plant removal needs a resource consent. So it's the third box, and that's the one that says, does the indigenous vegetation within the area to be cleared qualify to be counted? And if it doesn't,
in terms of the fine rules, you think that we don't have indigenous vegetation. And there's other, I'm not saying they're the best district plans in the world, but there's other operative district plans such as Waitaki and Mackenzie that have, in the definition of indigenous vegetation, they have the 20% and 30% wildfires within them, but I've purposely taken them out of the definition and put them into the chapter so you can read those when you go to apply the rule, or else somebody could simply read the rules in the district plan and be scratching their head as to the permitted removal, but you could overlook that sort of critical 20% or 30%. If you didn't have them, then fundamentally there could be a whole lot of indigenous vegetation that doesn't qualify, that would be counted. So essentially the 20% or the 30% is a is fundamentally a balance or a concession, saying that, you know, just because it's indigenous vegetation, it's obviously part of a community if it exceeds those thresholds. And moving on from that, the I think it's a bit more simplified breaking up the tenting there issue as well. So on the bigger land holdings such as wooden farms, sites over 10 hectares, it's simply a case of if it's more than half a hectare, you'll need consent. The vegetation is over 2 metres in height, you can only clear 500 square metres, and if it's within a chronically or acutely threatened land environment, you can clear 500 metres square.
So it's at least two, it's basically on this one here, just about the on the it's, if it's the answer is yes to any of those, it goes over to here. Only one.
So
these are all individual.
It's yes to any. Originally, when I actually drafted this, I had three separate boxes, but we consolidated them into one to make it a bit simpler. But it's yes to any of those qualifiers. You can see them set out. As you see, there's different limbs in table two.
Right. So it has to be known to all of them, basically. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, there's no hand laws, it's just simply three separate standards, but they're pressing the point box.
Any other questions?
I'm going to try the third box down.
That's what we spent a lot of time talking about today, which is rule 33.3, in terms of the 20% and 30%.
Give us a flow diagram about how you answer that question.
the third box question.
Yeah. Mm. I mean that's what we're trying to, yeah, I mean that's what we're trying to get a handle on, because that seems to be a point of contention. And if I'm not saying we're going to go one way or the other, but I just like to get it. And I don't mind if you include the rules and clarification points that you're referring to so that we understand the process that someone would have to go through to get to that, understand the answer, to get to be able to answer that question. That's the nub of what we need to do. And I don't mind if you include that as a reply, but I think that's quite important.
So the rule numbering would really, I think, really help rather than complicate it because of what we've heard today. And the other thing is that we probably wouldn't want Mr. Barr to show this to the junior of Simpson Grayson that's doing the reading of the rules. Don't show them this. So that person should be operating independently of all of this so that they just provide that test.
Mm.
Yeah, I accept now that in the table two rule, especially where it relates to the land environment in New Zealand, it's technically correct and refers to the 20% is referring to the chronically and acutely threatened land environments, but I can clearly see the 20% has confused people in terms of treating that as a threshold for vegetation to be removed.
Yeah.
So you could simply say, and because those areas are identified in the schedule in the plan already, you could simply say in this area, in that schedule, it's 500 square metres or 50 square metres.
Well, that's not what I'm doing. I don't mind, but I think
answering that question, I think, is quite, and how, which rule you need to read and how you get to the answer, I think is quite important for us to understand.
Yeah, I'm happy to provide that, and that would be in the right revises with the rules
that
we provide. Okay,
thank
you.
So it's useful to get this earlier, though, so that...
Yes, yeah.
Mr. Clark, do you know if there's any scientific origin to the 500 or 5,000 square metres a day?
No, sorry. The 5,000 is in the operative district plan, and it is arbitrary. It's something that I don't think that...
Carryovers a bit.
Yes, the farming community wanted to lose.
Yep.
But at the same time, as you'll hear or you read in the technical reports, there's obviously the pressure for these, and especially in those dryland areas that also coincide as being identified as chronically and acutely threatened land environments. There's 5,000 square metres is quite a lot to remove for permitted activity. So that's him basically. It's a bit arbitrary where we took a zero off the end, and on smaller sites we took another zero off the end as well. I mean, I appreciate this, that transaction costs of resource consents, but at the end of the day, the resource consent process is to identify if there's any values, and I think sometimes it's a bit overlooked.
But presumably there's some sort of ecological judgment as well.
Mr. Davis is supportive of the 500 square metres in terms of the balance. Yeah, there's other solutions. The Forest and Bird, as you hear, the Forest and Bird submission essentially has no clearance, but it wants a finer grained description of the community that would be removed. So we haven't gone with that. So there are other alternatives in terms of capturing the types of communities and the thresholds for removal, and I think you'll find that some submitters probably aren't happy with the 500 square metre. There could be a chance that there's an ECNA in that vegetation that would be lost as a permitted activity. So these are trying to, they are actually trying to sort of balance a degree of simplicity and the ability for a layperson to interpret them without making it too onerous in terms of having no clearance at all.
The identification of those SPNAs has been a very long amount of time. And how were they actually chosen? Were councils considered them to be not thorough? And so how have they ended up being identified as areas that would be considered as SPNAs? But then there's other areas that seem to have not been considered at all.
I'd say that the ones that are in the proposed district plan are thorough. I don't know how the council arrived at the existing schedule that's in the operative plan, and at the moment the proposed plan schedules are slightly set apart and they'll ultimately be merged. It's a non-material change, but I kind of wanted to show that distinction. But I think quite a lot of rigor has gone into the identification of the ECNAs for the proposed district plan. It's essentially set out in Mr. Davis' evidence, and a lot of it is based on the Land Environment New Zealand classification, which is picked up in the draft national policy statement in terms of the four, I think, sort of thresholds that were important in terms of sort of triggers for that. One thing that Mr. Davis didn't really talk about in his evidence or his oral submission was that he's been processing resources, he's been helping the council on resource consents for the better part of at least 10 years, and with private landowners as well. So when those resource consents get granted, a lot of them for high country birding, quite large areas, but there were areas on the resource consents that were excluded. And it's sort of no surprise that when Mr. Davis is firmly involved in this project, that a lot of those areas were picked up as being potentially significant. So there was that institutional knowledge of the district between him and his ecologist colleagues to identify those as well. But fundamentally, we think the process is pretty robust in terms of the identification of them.
So the potential to go on to Manybell's land and find an area that would sort of capture some of this is low?
I think that if Mr. Davis, I mean, we're definitely not saying that we've got all the areas, and I think Doc is stressing that point. And I think that the PDP's kept it open in terms of identifying other sites, but I think that if it was there, Mr. Davis or his ecologist brothers would have known about it.
Has he been on the land or not before?
On the Cripple Station land? I'm not sure, I can't answer that.
One of my observations is that if you're looking for something where you've never looked before, you'll find something. Yeah. In fact, I remember when they did the extension of the Tongariro to Chapo, it was a dock office about 500 metres away, and they had a 10-year program of wasp control, and we had an ecological assessment done on the area of beech forest, and they found the largest population of the rarest mistletoe in New Zealand, and it was right under Doc's nose, and they just hadn't noticed it. And it's just that nobody had the time or money to pay for someone to go and have a look. Yeah. So as soon as you go and have a look, then there's going to be stuff there. Right?
We're about 15 to 20 sites that we've taken forward, and I think I've included that as an appendix in the section 32, somewhere it's buried in there. So, and that was to show that there was a selective process, and then a few sites did drop off. And there's quite large sites like Lake Harvey Station. There's also that issue with sites going through a tenure review process and waiting for that to happen as well. I mean, one of the last sites we got was in, not we got, but one of the last sites we identified through for SNAs was at Alpha Burn on the side of Mount Roy, and it's because they finished tenure review and the applicant needed a resource consent. So they started looking at the resource consent to clear the bracken, which is actually one of the photos in here. We picked up those sites. That's just the image with the bracken, this one here actually. So there's that balance as well with knowing that a high country station is going through tenure review and whether or not it's letting that process run as well. But
reason making the point that I just did is that if you're looking for something, you can find it. But of course, the more that you find it, the less rare it was in the first place. So it's a kind of chicken situation, isn't it?
I mean, and this is if Mrs. Bell likes to invite the council's ecologist on her property for inspection, we'd be happy to do so. But at this stage of that hearing, Mr. Davis, I think that you would have had more than a strong suspicion that there was something on that property. But a lot of that comes from having been on the site process, you know, looking at resource consent issues on it as well. So,
yeah. So she having a reason to look.
That's right.
Is there a rough figure, do you know, how much it would cost, say, one pivot area to have an assessment done? I guess it all depends on what's found.
That's right. You'd have to ask an ecologist and how many hours they'd have to spend on their hands and knees looking at the site, but asking if it could be dirt.
40 or 50 hectares.
Yeah, that's right. It could be a couple of days in the field, and perhaps an ecologist is worth somewhere between $120 to $200 an hour. So you'd be looking at spending a few $1,000 getting an assessment done, and you're looking at spending that initially plus some more if you need to apply for resource consent, and there could be a lot of negotiation with the ecologist before you go forward with the area once you're removed. I think everyone would say that's still a lot cheaper than having to use an ecologist and legal counsel if you remove indigenous vegetation without a resource consent.
If you found out.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got it sitting there, it doesn't identify anything, then you could carry on with limited activity and don't need to apply for COC.
In terms of ignorance bliss?
No, if you've got an ecologist, you paid an ecologist
right.
to do it, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Then.
That's right. And you probably want to take photographs to show that after you've cultivated it. If somebody asks a question, you could show, so you're not doing your, ad hoc trying to say that there was no indigenous vegetation there. I think that conversations today were around applying the rules in past tense from an enforcement point of view, but it's not the intent. The idea is to apply the rules before you, while you're contemplating removing the existing vegetation, or seeing how much clear is a permitted activity, and potentially what the impacts are if you want to go
so
beyond.
I mean, I think to be fair, we're focused on how you would apply those rules and what cost would be.
The council didn't have a policy up when these rules were made operative. The council had a working policy to pay for ecological assessments, and that isn't active anymore, as far as I'm aware. But there's also that sort of tension between a landowner being an applicant, perhaps they're happy to pay for their own agent in terms of the case they're putting forward as well. But there was about a 6 or 7 at least year history of the council paying for ecological assessments, and I think that was part of the fallout of the operative district plan and the consent order and the what we see in Appendix 5 of the district plan in terms of the significant indigenous vegetation program that the council were compelled to undertake.
Okay.
Just one more. Sorry. Then how do we do from a couple of stations irrigation potential, or they were already irrigating, and we're picking up more. How many stations do you think are in the district overall that could contemplate the irrigation as a way of
all canine irrigation?
I was going to say, if they've got flat land and they've got water, and they don't mind paying the power bill, probably quite a few. But even in K-line, you can use K-line quite intensively. I think probably a good disadvantage that would be Lakeland High Station, because I think they have a large bit of irrigated down on the flat, just south of one career
board.
But all the green flats that you can see, so if you're on King Road looking back towards the Beeler Range, you'll see all that green on the upper terraces. So I'm guessing that they irrigate that with K-line, and I think they've got a thing to take from the Lovey Creek sort of Sheepskin Creek catchment.
How difficult it is to look on the Otago Regional Council's GIS system to see where water permits are identified as that?
I think it was.
Not as easy as
expected. No. Most of them are finding rights at the moment. That's only when they'll expire that you can do that. Even Gibson Valley, most of the vineyards are on mining rights.
Fundamentally, as well, including clearance in the definition means that in some circumstances.
No, I didn't ask you that. Sorry. Stop there.
Right from my.
Yeah.
So, moving on to the maps. So
we've heard from half a dozen already. You see quite a few. Are you saying there could be potentially a large number of landowners that could get caught by that?
They have to have indigenous vegetation on their land that will trigger clearance. And it's not just about vivid irrigators, it's about using K-line and small scale methods. You're right, it could be, but it depends on the coverage. It would depend on the circumstances, which is where I was getting to that comment. Mr. Nijan wasn't leading in something I wasn't asked to lead into, but fundamentally it's just recognising that in certain circumstances, water constitutes clearance, just like spraying herbicide, just like putting a set of discs through the land would constitute clearance. So, from our perspective, it's a technical issue, and it's just sort of making sure that things don't slip through the gaps.
Perfect. It's a simple way to answer that question. Would it be realistic to say that every farm in the district, if they could, would irrigate somewhere?
Yes, relative to the cost of the cost of the irrigation relative to the reserves, but I think
if they could get a spring for out and the water was no issue, then
getting enough flow. I mean, often the issue is getting enough flow to and that might involve electricity, and that's expensive.
I thought the maps were so explanatory. Do we have any questions about the maps? But the answer to the issue of the state highways and the rural living zones. Is a very nice one.
Does the map show where which bits are limited access roads and which are not?
No, they don't. And if you ask them, sorry, I didn't think you didn't recall that as just
I can't recall whether we asked that or not either.
So we do have, for better or for worse, we do have guidance in the designations chapter in the plan, in the proposed plan, about where they are. So we said it wouldn't be hard to point them out.
My thing is that part of the reason for upsetting this was to understand the relationship between where the roads are and where the rules for a lot of the issues might actually apply.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's something different that applies because it is a limited access road, if there's not any rule that relates to limited access road, or that that's something that NZTA raised in submissions or anything like that?
No, my understanding from the NZTA submission that it relates to state highway, so it doesn't distinguish between limited access road.
Right.
And there's a key here as well, so obviously you're familiar about the yellow rural zone, light green is the very light green is the rural residential zone, and the darker green is the rural lifestyle zone, so that's...
The other thing I was going to possibly suggest through the chair was whether this should possibly be sent directly to Mr. McColl at NZTA, hasn't done so already, particularly since he's on tomorrow, because we might have some questions.
Yeah, that's right. I'll just send him a copy personally.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I'll do so 11:10.
Yeah.
So 11:10.